The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratowski. As we're recording this week's podcast, Microsoft is getting ready to announce the acquisition of Skype, the voice over internet protocol telephone service, for an expected $7 to $8 billion. Meanwhile, Nokia, once the impenetrable market leader in the mobile market, has witnessed serious setbacks thanks to the indefatigable rise of smartphones. Also, in a few minutes, we'll be discussing the fractures that have appeared within the mighty Anonymous, the shady hacker organization accused of breaking into closed systems from PlayStation Network to ACS Law. We'll seek out the schisms and try to identify what each substratum thinks the group stands for. Joining me to discuss these stories is Charles Arthur. Welcome to the studio, Charles.
Well, hello.
Also, our guest this week is Tom Loosemore. Tom, would you describe yourself as the web strategist? How would you describe yourself and your role for the UK government? Because you're not the Twitter czar. I'm sad about
not
that.
The Twitter czar.
Because then you could catch the Twitterer who's been written about for super injunction and breaking.
I'd love to know who the Twitter czar is. Who is the czar that's calling everyone Twitter czar?
The czar czar.
The czar czar.
Czar
galore. Yeah. Ding. I don't know how to describe myself. I'm having fun building interesting things in government.
You're a minister without portfolio.
I'm certainly not a minister, that's for sure.
Well, then you're without portfolio, but you're living, you're ensconced within the bowels of the Cabinet Office, building amazing things for the government.
Yeah, I'm building an alpha version of a new single government website, which is a lot of fun.
And we shall be talking more about that also later in the program. So keep listening to all of these stories and more over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First in this week's news, Microsoft is understood to have reached an agreement with Skype, the voice over IP telephone alternative, to purchase the service for around $8 billion. Charles, what do we know about this deal?
Well, it was being discussed last week, and at the time, Facebook and Google were thought to be in the frame for it. But Microsoft seemed to make a late run, so to speak, to come in for it. The details seem to be that Microsoft wants it to integrate into its online services division, the one that lives with Bing, and possibly to integrate it into other services such as Office. It's very unclear. We're speaking ahead of the formal announcement, which is expected at 1 p.m. British summer time on Tuesday. And quite what Microsoft wants out of it is not clear.
What are the benefits of integrating it into something like online services where, as you say, Bing lives, or into Office? I mean, it seems quite strange to put it into Office.
I think that Microsoft wants to make itself a cool brand for consumers, because the Office franchise, the Windows franchise, which are the ones which makes money out of businesses, those are sort of, they're okay. They're cooling off a bit, the Windows franchise especially, although the Office is going well. But what Steve Ballmer really wants to do is to make Microsoft a cool brand with consumers again. And Skype is seen as a cool brand. So it's a good thing in that sense. You could argue, and there might be some people who are arguing that in the years to come, we're all going to be doing voice over IP calling, that actually we're not going to be making calls to mobile numbers. We're going to be making calls to handles, which sort of happens already. You know, if you're on a mobile, then you tend to dial people by their sort of name in your address book. So you could sort of see a situation where Microsoft is saying, hey, we're just going to integrate this. It'll be in our Windows Phone mobile operating system. You'll be using Skype and you'll have all your contacts integrated. It'll be really great. You won't spend so much money. I'm less convinced about that, because I think that actually the way we use voice, the way we use mobile numbers as a handle, is far more pervasive and really difficult to get rid of. So you start to look at, well, okay, maybe it's something to do with integration with Office. I'm writing a book at the moment, which is about Google, Microsoft and Apple and how they've all been having business rivalries down the years. One of the things that emerges from the people I've spoken to who've been at Microsoft and are at Microsoft is that the Office division guards its property really jealously. You want to get something integrated into Office? Tough luck. So there was a point when Microsoft was working on relaunching its search engine, sort of 2003, 4 or 5, and they went to the Office division and said, hey, let's integrate the search function into Office. It'll be really great. Even Bill Gates thought it'd be really great. Office guys said, No, I'm not going to do that. Same with tablets. The people who came up with the tablet division went to Office and said, hey, listen, let's get Office running on tablets really well. The Office guy said, no, I don't like it. Didn't happen. The Office people already have a voice over IP service called Link, which is integrated into some of the services. I think that getting Skype integrated into Office is going to be a hell of a political fight, and that's going to be cats in a bag job.
Tom, with your former Ofcom hat on, I'd be curious to know, what is the relationship between Skype as a, you know, as a communication platform and the carriers globally, and how will this affect?
Well, I was lucky enough not to work in the bit of Ofcom that I had to deal day to day with the telecoms companies. But my understanding is that a significant chunk of Skype's revenue comes from connection charges, where there's a guarantee of revenue from the person you're connected, the network you're connecting to. From my perspective, that's not necessarily the most stable business driver, really, in terms of revenue. If you're relying on regulation as your core form of revenue globally, you've got a risk there. As Charles said, the theory is voice over IP is free. As long as you've got internet connection, you should be able to get voice. I'm intrigued here about integration with MSN Messenger, if I'm honest. That strikes me as a much more obvious place to plug in Skype.
But they've already got their own VoIP. I mean,
you can do it already.
MSN Messenger has its own VoIP.
But if they're thinking this is a play for scale, this is about becoming the default canonical place to make free or nearly free phone calls from your device that isn't a telephone. And I'm with Charles. I think the phone number is here to stay for a fairly long while yet. If you're looking at other devices, if you're looking for conversation, video, or speech over other devices, then a combination of Skype and MSN Messenger, just in volume of users terms, is pretty significant. It's a network play, a critical mass play.
But here's the problem. Okay, you've got lots of users. So what? You can't monetize them. And this is the problem that Skype has. You look at the numbers where last year they had something like $850 million revenue, I think, and they managed to make a loss on it. The sort of numbers in terms of what money they get out of people works out to $1.30 per user per year. So you're talking about 11 cents per month per user.
And actually, I have to say, as a Skype user, they recently gave me a dollar worth of Skype credit just because they said thank you very much for being a regular Skype user. So they only made 33 cents out of me that year.
Well, right. So you have this problem, which is okay, everyone uses your service, but who cares? And also, just imagine the joy you're going to have when the deal is done, and here you are sitting down in Microsoft, and you say, okay, what we're going to do? We're going to integrate it with MSN Messenger and Xbox Live. All the handles, we're going to do it. And the guy says, okay, SQL, left join, Xbox Live handle, Skype handle, MSN Messenger handle. That is going to be the SQL left join to rule them all. And you're going to get the most horrendous calamity when they try to put all those together.
What's Skype's acquisition history? Because they had a relationship with eBay.
They were set up in 2003 and grew very rapidly because everyone said, hey, this is really great. 2005, eBay said, these people are really terrific. Bought them for $2.6 billion. And everyone said, hey, this is brilliant. Skype is going to be integrated into auction so that when the auction is approaching, you can ring up the bidder or you can ring up the seller and you can say, hey, listen, tell me, is this a really good thing to buy or is it really rubbish? You can do video chat. It'll be wonderful. eBay is going to integrate it. It's going to rule the world. Didn't happen. No one wants to talk on eBay about the items that they're buying and selling. Just is not the way that eBay works. So it just sort of was sort of the unloved stepchild. Meg Whitman was getting a lot of heat over the fact that they spent all this money on Skype and were getting no return. So in 2009, I think it was, they sold 70% of it off in a debt acquisition where Skype and some venture capital partners bought it back. That saddled Skype with about $800-900 billion of debt. Great if you can borrow it from the banks. Yeah, it's a great thing. Left eBay with 30% of it, which they wrote down the value. If Microsoft is buying it for around $8 billion, then eBay is going to make money on it overall on the acquisition and sale, which is nice news for them. But for everyone else, they say, how the hell has this thing gone from zero to $2.6 to $8 billion, and yet it doesn't make any money, and you can't see a way in which it will?
Tom, final word.
Corporate trophy.
All right. Well, then, we'll take that one to parties. Thank you very much. Also this week, more bad news for Nokia as its handsets tumble down the rankings behind the Android handsets, the iPhone, and Samsung. Charles, what's the latest in mobile news?
These are some numbers that have come out from IDC, the analysts, who have done their figures for Western Europe phone shares for the first quarter of 2011. These tend to lag behind the PC numbers. They find it much easier to follow the PC numbers than they do the phone numbers. And what it shows is that for total handsets, that's sort of feature phones and smartphones, Samsung had the lead in the first quarter of 2011, 13.2 handsets shipped. That means it pushed Nokia down to second place, Nokia 12.6. And that was actually a fall in the number of handsets that Nokia shipped in Western Europe. It's a fall of 10%. Apple was third with just 4.4. So it's one-third roughly the size in terms of Nokia, about a quarter of the size of Samsung. But that's for total handsets. And all of those are smartphones. And that's 50% growth compared to 3 million the year before. And in smartphones, Apple was actually the top smartphone shipper in Western Europe, 4.4 million, pushing Nokia down, which had 4.2. Again, that's a fall for Nokia in the number of smartphones shipped in Western Europe. So Nokia's got a bad problem.
What do they need to do to reestablish themselves as a contender?
They need to have a smartphone platform that people believe is actually worth buying. And also, they need to persuade people that the Nokia brand is one where they'll find phones and interaction that they actually want. Because you couldn't say that Nokia hasn't spent money on advertising. God, you can't go into a tube station or walk along a street without seeing a big Nokia billboard. But I think that they're pushing the wrong thing. They've been doing TV adverts as well. They're pushing the N8, they're pushing the 7. They're saying, look, hey, it's got a fantastic camera on it. And you think, why do I care about the camera on a smartphone? They say, you can do lots of things. You can plug it. You can plug the HDMI into your TV. And I think, I have actually asked this question on Twitter. I've said, who wants to watch HDMI content? What HDMI content do you have on your mobile phone that you want to then watch on your TV? What? Why? It's like they've got completely the wrong answer to the question. Whereas Apple, you look at their ads on TV and they say, if you haven't got an iPhone, you can't do this, you can't do that. Nokia is just not in the game at all. So Nokia's signed a deal in February by which it's going to be offering Microsoft's Windows Phone OS on its smartphones. That I don't expect to happen before October. But I think that even so, they're going to have a problem because they're going to be selling the Windows Phone smartphones alongside Symbian smartphones, the ones they have now. I think that's going to create confusion in the market because people will say, why are we getting these? Which one should we be going for? And what's quite clear that they're doing is they're starting to push all the smartphones out to China. China, they sold nearly 9 million smartphones out there. They're clearly, dumping might be too strong a word, but I think that they're focusing their efforts, possibly at lower cost than before, for their smartphones in the Far East, where the market is growing fast.
Now, it's interesting that you say that there's this distinction between how somebody like Apple and somebody like Nokia are focusing their attentions. You think about the types of things that Nokia are pushing. We've got this great camera, or you can share your videos, you can watch them on TV. Tom, are they just simply looking at a consumer that's out of date, and Apple is now sort of the leader when it comes to this is the lifestyle choice? What's the difference here?
Two things to say, really. One, Nokia still sell an awful lot of phones, an awful lot more phones than Apple do. The fact that we all obsess with smartphones, it is a massively growing market. We shouldn't lose sight of that.
Well, yeah, but smartphones were 47% of the handsets shipped
I think that has that defense of Nokia, I was going on to say, has now shifted to being untenable. They are culturally in the wrong place. They are a hardware business. That made them great. It's now going to kill them. Apple is not a hardware business. They are a let's make things that people love business. And nowadays, in terms of smartphones, what thing people care most about is the overall experience. And that means getting your software brilliant. Nokia's software, Symbian, has been a train crash, built on software that's 20 years out of date. Literally, there's code in there that's 20 years old at the base of Symbian. And it's just not been good enough for 4, 5, 6 years. And the good news from Nokia is I think they know at senior levels that they're dead. You know, they wouldn't have done such a really desperate deal as the Windows Media for such a radical deal as that if they hadn't realised that if they carried on the same course with the culture of hardware engineers driving their products, which is what's been happening, they were going to die and they needed to take the software side seriously. I fear it's too late, personally.
Finally, it happens in every successful community. There comes a time when a group gets too big and the issues that it stands for become fractured and fragmented. Some researchers, like Robin Dunbar at the University of Oxford, believes that the ideal group size is 150 and any more than that, and the collective begins to lose its central focus. But does this apply to ideological groups like those who gather on the internet? Of course it does. A powerful example is Anonymous, the banner around which a global network of computer-savvy troublemakers have coagulated, spawning from the image-posting forum 4chan, and who have claimed responsibility for high-profile attacks on everybody from Scientology, ACS Law, and banking systems like Visa and MasterCard. Now, each of the target organizations have been attacked because they represent or are associated with so-called enemies of Anonymous, whether it's L. Ron Hubbard's cult, the RIAA, or threats to freedom of information site WikiLeaks. Tech Weekly has come under fire from people close to Anonymous in the past for suggesting that it is an organization, that it actually, you know, it has an organizational structure. Its proponents argue that it's more like a franchise, kind of like McDonald's or Starbucks, which I'm sure they'd be thrilled to think that they're associated with that. But the people who do call themselves part of Anonymous act independently on behalf of what Anonymous purports as a collective to believe. Charles, what on earth is Anonymous?
From my dealings with people who are involved in it and from having gone into chat rooms and sort of watched the whole process go around, there's two ways you can think of it. The first way, and possibly the easiest way to think of it, is as being like a flock of birds. They've got an objective and they tend to fly in that direction. But, you know, some birds might join, some birds might not join. And if one bird decides to fly off in a different direction, that could make the whole flock change direction. So that's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is, I don't know if you've ever been on the London Underground, but you get sort of, sometimes you go up the escalators and you'll see about what seems like 100 children, and sort of scattered through them, there's a couple of adults. And the kids are all excited and really talking about everything. And it's really wonderful. And the adults are all sort of thinking, okay, now we're going to go over here. So you can also think about Anonymous a bit like that. They're the really experienced people who are driving where it's going, and they're the really excited people who are not quite so experienced.
Well, in wake of the recent accusations against Anonymous for breaking into the PlayStation Network's client database and Anonymous's assertions that it wasn't them because they apparently they have a political agenda, which is what they've come out to say, it seems that individuals, whether it's individual birds or individual children, claiming to be one of Anonymous aren't the unified voice that they once were. So, Charles, what have they actually said about the PlayStation Network attacks?
Anonymous said that their objective was not to steal credit card details, but a couple of things have emerged over the weekend. There have been some people from the top level, you know, sort of the adults in the escalator, who've been suggesting that, yeah, actually, maybe some people from Anonymous were talking about, you know, some of the vulnerabilities that they might have seen, which would allow them perhaps to hack into some of the servers, you know, that had some of the details. Yeah, could be. Yeah, I've tried to get confirmation from my own Anonymous sources. Anonymous sources, obviously. To be honest, I've not had much in the way of response. But you know, the people who are writing about this, Tim Bradshaw and Joseph Menn at the FT, are people who I trust to know what's going on. Also, there's a webpage, the anonops.com, I think it is, which has said that there's a split at the top of Anonymous now, where one of the people who, you know, one of the adults on the escalator has decided to take the ball away and start attacking some of the Anonymous systems. So there does seem to be signs of a split, signs of lots of discord, disagreement about what's going on, and people just getting basically irked with each other because I think they can't agree on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to have attacked Sony, whether the objectives they're following are the right ones, and, you know, just people getting a bit annoyed with each other.
Tom, what might this all mean for the power of Anonymous as a brand, as a sort of hacker entity, if they are starting to eat themselves, literally, if they're starting to attack one another?
Oh, I think I'd take a step back and say they are only a brand because the media were lazy enough to describe them as a brand. And it's quite heartening to hear you two talking a bit more sophistication about if you have an organisation that you've become a member of by saying you're Anonymous and putting "We Are Legion," you know, insert Spartacus. you know, context here. You are perforce not a coherent, singular, centrally controlled entity. You are fractal. You're chaotic in the sort of scientific sense. And I think that what you've just been describing are the symptoms of an organisation that has probably more coherence than it might actually has a right to expect. How do you know you're talking to anonymous sources, Charles? Really?
Sure.
And I mean, the parallels, it's a very extreme case, but the parallels with Al-Qaeda
they
jump out, to be honest.
Yeah, and ultimately, we're not suggesting that, that Anonymous is in any way associated with a terrorist organization. But what is interesting is that they have come out and they've said that their agenda is political. It's not, you know, trying to attack individuals. So whether they're looking at things like the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, or they're attacking people who attack who aren't supporting WikiLeaks because they feel that that's their agenda that they want to promote. But if you do have these kinds of fractal mercenaries, if you do have these excitable kids on the escalator or these starlings that are flying off and navigating on their own, surely that then becomes a little bit more dangerous because the entity known as Anonymous, it loses control. There is no longer a kind of central force. So what effect and how can people try to control this ambiguous fractal?
I genuinely don't know if there ever was any central control.
It's questionable. Yeah, I mean, you could go into the chat rooms and you could see that there wasn't any agreement. There was no control. It really was birds flying around a room trying to find a window. And you know, some would say, "Hey, I think there's a window over there," and they'd all go in that direction. And another say, "No, I don't think that's a window." And you know, the birds are trying to escape the room. They can't quite find where they're going to, but eventually they might hit on it by luck or by just accord.
Or they may simply just fragment and dissipate into absolutely. Different smaller groups.
I mean, I would say I think the do not underestimate the anger, and I think the on some levels their anger has justification if. There's significant, not everywhere, but significant anger about PlayStation 3 and the case in the States where Sony took someone who had turned their PlayStation machine into a more general purpose computer. They had bought a machine and changed its purpose. And then Sony decided that was, despite the fact they'd sold a machine to someone, they'd broken somehow the terms of use for that machine and had taken said person to court.
George Holtz.
That strikes me, I mean, Charles will know much more than I do, that strikes me as something from a consumer perspective to be pretty outraged about. And I'm glad, as a political movement, they have highlighted that case. I'd rather they hadn't stolen, my son's friend's parents' credit cards. But if it were indeed then, I don't think we'll ever know, frankly. Very convenient excuse for Sony, let's be clear. Very convenient excuse.
Yeah. What do you think, though, given that they are, you know, they are starting to make pretty real threats, you know, if people are going into if they are going into the PlayStation network, if they are trying to take down various banking enterprises, if they are hacking into legal firms, they are actually starting to demonstrate that they have wings. If we continue along with this bird child scenario,
I think that the difference, and you know, the key difference, if you really want an absolutely fundamental difference between, you know, Al-Qaeda, because we're only comparing that in terms of a sort of a loose organization, an idea driving, rather than, you know, having a head who could be sort of directed to be taken out. The thing about Anonymous, I think, is that it's much more about, we think these things are hidden and they should be in the open. And I think that there's, as Tom says, there's anger there, but there's also an idealism about, don't hide these things away, put them out in the open, you know. And so for Sony, you know, the message is, don't hide this stuff away. The attacks against organizations that tried to throttle off WikiLeaks payments, the argument was, WikiLeaks is doing something we think is good because it's making it open. Don't put that away. The attacks on the RIAA, the attacks on ACS Law, those were about, don't try to break the model of the internet by somehow, you know, doing things. And you know, you could sort of see it in a situation where if whoever's been spreading, you know, super injunction data on Twitter somehow came to be arraigned in front of a court, that the Anonymous might take it on themselves to attack the court system because they don't like that. But I think they would stop short, and they, you know, and this is actually the line they wouldn't want to cross. They'd stop short at the point where they do physical damage to something.
Well, you can read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology.
A few months ago, this week's studio guest, Tom Loosemore, came in to discuss direct.gov.uk, the catch-all consumer-facing government services website that was to replace the sprawling chaos of the government's current web services landscape. Since then, Tom has been heads down working internally at the Cabinet Office with a small team of developers. And this week, they released the alpha version of the site. Tom, what can you tell us about it?
It's going to be beautiful. I hope. Take a step back again. Last autumn, Marjolaine Fox was asked by the Cabinet Office, by Francis Maud, the Cabinet Minister, to take a good hard look at government online. And I was lucky enough to help her do that piece of work. That report, which is published at the end of November, recommended revolution or evolution in how government delivers its services online. And I was very lucky to be given the opportunity to be given the rarest of thing in government, a blank sheet of paper, to very quickly, in government terms, in 3 months, with a very small team, a mixture of people inside government already and some great people from outside too, to say, OK, if you were going to start again with a blank sheet of paper, delivering government online, what would that begin to look like? It really is an early alpha. I mean, one of the things that's different here is government doesn't generally release betas, let alone alphas. We're trying to really take a bold step here and put some ideas out there about if you're going to be ruthlessly obsessed with delivering what people actually want from government rather than delivering things in the structure of government via department or whatever, how would you do so? So it's far from complete. It might even not be accurate, some of the stuff in there. We're really putting it live for a couple of months to say, what do people think about the overall approach, about the information architecture, about the user experience decisions we've made, about the language we've used. It's all about the feedback.
Is this trying to cope with problems associated with criticisms of how much excess is being spent on the hundreds of government websites? Or is this really focusing on what it is that people want out of government?
Both. I mean, the strong and overriding driver has been simplicity, because how do we make things as simple as possible for people in terms of getting what they need from government online? It's a forced purchase using government online. I'd be lying if I didn't say there wasn't a significant opportunity to save significant sums of money.
Looking at the blog, the blog.alpha.gov.uk blog, it's got some interesting things. I mean, the latest blog post is we are not the first to tread this path, but you're talking about things like HMRC offering APIs, which I didn't know they even
you
did.
You need to learn these things.
Foreign hundreds. And Commonwealth Office, DEFRA, Job Centre Plus, Shropshire Council, DVLA, Companies House. I mean, there's a lot of big name involvement here, isn't there?
Well, I mean, to be clear, those are not people who've been day-to-day involved there. We wanted to point to the fact that there are some great examples of really good stuff happening in government. The fact you didn't know about HMRC, to be honest, I didn't when I started helping Martha. HMRC, what they do with APIs is incredible. They deliver the vast majority of transactions online, not via the government's own website, via third parties. So there's a flourishing market out there for services on top of are built on top of those APIs. They just don't call them APIs because they come from a different culture than we do. there's a whole software development community there. It's amazing.
Translation surely has been an enormous hurdle for you, coming from the software side and coming from the development side. What have been some of the major challenges?
To be honest, the there's only ever one challenge of doing something in government, and that's doing anything in government. The act of doing something is the hardest thing. I have huge respect and sympathy for people who deliver things inside the government. You can slag off people to your heart's content, but until you've tried to do it, I won't hear from you, frankly.
What are the obstacles, then?
It's a bureaucracy. It's the most effective bureaucracy in the history of the known universe, I'd argue. It's an amazing institution, the UK Civil Service, with amazing ability to sometimes make life harder for itself than it needs to. And when you're trying to introduce a radical new lens on how you deliver government services online, which I hope alpha.gov.uk is the beginnings of, it would be very surprising if things weren't difficult. We're cutting across all sorts of organisational boundaries, all sorts of previously understood ways of working, and it would be a surprise if it had been easy, frankly.
The bureaucracy, though, it means that right-hand and left hand and right foot and left foot simply don't talk to one another. So how have you managed to create an ecosystem that's not only open, not only transparent, which is something that throughout your entire career you have been a proponent of, but also engages all of the different departments, everybody from DVLA to number 10?
Well, I think if you talk to people inside government, they'd be pointing you to another post there. By Jimmy Leach, who's the head of digital at the Foreign Office, who we have had closely involved in the project. He's been part of the team, which basically says we didn't talk to people. We started with a blank sheet of paper and we ran as far and fast as we could with a fresh perspective. Now, in the past few weeks, I have been going around government. I've been going around the country showing different departments what we've done. But I could easily have spent 6 months consulting with people before we started. The whole point of doing an alpha was to show people what Martha meant by a simple single domain that put the needs of citizens ahead of the needs of departments. We felt it was important to show that in code and show that government can develop things really quickly in an agile, multidisciplinary way, cheaply, relatively cheaply, rather than just produce another document arguing the case.
Well, oftentimes when you do go to government websites, you're simply directed to documents. So how is this going to be different? How is this going to... ultimately, when it comes to it, the services that individuals need is they need the information. That's why they go to government services. So by trying to integrate, whether it's community or trying to create networks or trying to create all the different bells and whistles... isn't that kind of making things more complicated?
We haven't done anything sexy like that at all.
It's still documents.
No, it's not. It's not documents. When you look at what the services citizens, businesses expect from government online, it's a hugely diverse set of needs. There is the bulk of citizens have a relatively narrow set of needs. I need to pay my car tax. I've lost my passport. What do I do? I want to take a driving test. Those kind of needs. And we've put the bulk of our effort, if I'm honest, into trying to make those as simple as possible. Businesses have needs too. We really haven't dwelt too much on that. We've done a little bit. However, there's a whole suite of other much more specialist audiences that rely on government online. For example, it is absolutely right and proper that every single government department has an effective website to tell the world what it's doing, how it spends its money, what its priorities are, who works there. I would argue it's not an acceptable thing for every single one of those departments to have a completely different website, run as a complete silo in a different way with a different user experience and a different contract. So we've built the beginnings of a platform for government departments to tell the world what they're doing.
And in addition, each of these government websites or each of these different departments needs to have somebody to own this content as well. And in any, web strategy, that is one of the hardest elements.
Yeah, and some of them do have those people in place now. Some of them have several people, but they all suffer. And I think the people running those sites would be amongst the first to say this from, and I'll be bold here, a means of delivering internet services that is less than as effective as the market would generally think. They don't generally build things in-house. There are very few developers in government. Things are generally outsourced. Throwing specifications over the wall and having a supplier give something back model is not how you build great, cost-effective digital services in 2011.
I mean, it's interesting because we've had Margaret Manning of the Reading Room, which provides a lot of services to government in here, and she's described how there are just so many processes you have to go through. So they're doing, the classic case was doing the favicon, the little thing that appears in the browser bar for the Information Commissioner's Office. Someone designs it, then it has to go off to the company which will get it uploaded, which is different from the company that actually hosts it, and they all have to say, yeah, okay, this is good, and then it comes back to a sign-off, and so then it hasn't been signed off, it hasn't gone up the chain once, then the actual thing goes over, and that has to be checked each step of the way, and eventually it gets up there. The sheer slowness of it, I think, is the thing that people are amazed by. And yet at the same time, the argument that government shouldn't be employing tons and tons of programmers, because if you do, then they're going to have to be paid at civil service prices, which means that the market is going to siphon them off, and so you always have a shortage of people. Where is the answer? Because I've seen this argument go back and forth over 20 years.
I think the current way of doing things is death by governance. Is what you just described. Shorthand for that process, and that has to change. I take issue with you about developers. I think, take The Guardian. The Guardian employs developers at far below market rate. I can tell you that, and I can tell them that, because they want to work at The Guardian, because they care, and because The Guardian has created an environment where great developers can do great work.
It's also because we feed them biscuits every day.
Well, you know, maybe the government should feed them biscuits too. Ice creams is what I feed my team. I think that culture of a joined-up multidisciplinary team where you have a range of different skills, not just developers, but designers and the right editorial people too, and the right kind of agile project managers who know how to deliver digital services. What you can deliver with a relatively small team, and we've delivered this with a team of 10 or a dozen people throughout, nowadays, with modern open source web tools, is transformative compared to the existing model of writing a specification, throwing it out to tender to a relatively small group of companies who know how to respond to government tenders. Let's be clear, that's not a huge market. It's quite hard to take that approach. And where you do have a need where it is right for the market, for a small company out there or a large company out there to deliver an aspect of the service, then great, plug it in. But plug it into an environment that has been built for the whole of government would be.
How do you ensure that this doesn't become a behemoth that, you know, like the other government services in the past, you know, is a 10-15 year contract that after 10 or 15 years everything is so broken, is so, you know, out of date? How do you ensure that this evolves and is future proofed, not just for the technologies that we have now and the, you know, the languages that people are building in now? How do you ensure that it's agile and it can evolve organically?
It's the same with any large business. You do get to a point where you have to take a deep breath and start again. And, you know, for example, the BBC did that 2 or 3 years ago with its Perl-based infrastructure, and you know they're still struggling with the results, but it's the right thing to do. The Guardian did the same thing. Telegraph. Everyone has to take a deep breath eventually. The weird thing about government is there is no in-house platform at all. It's all outsourced.
Paper, isn't it? I thought that was in-house.
Yeah, but that, you know, costs a lot of money. It's like the pens that cost £20,000.
And, you know, and let's be clear, the vast bulk of government activities are delivered in relatively effectively every day via those outsourced contracts. They, you know, people do get paid. Pensions do get paid. You know, taxes are coming to the system. It kind of works, generally. In the very specific area I'm looking at, in terms of knowing what a great website should be and knowing what it should cost and how iterative and flexible and agile it should be, I'm not sure what's there at the moment is fit for purpose.
And finally, a lot of what Martha is aiming towards is to get, I think her figure was 100% of people online by 2012. Obviously, you know, that's a high target to reach. How is this part of that strategy?
Very simply, the best way to get the last 15-20% of people online is for their friends to tell them that things are easier online. Cheaper, easier, no hassle. At the moment, there are relatively few government services where people go around saying, you absolutely have to do this, it's brilliant, it saves you loads of time. Car tax is one of them. Actually, self-assessment is a good one as well, to be honest. I think it's a great transaction. You know, iPlayer from the BBC would be an example of almost like a verb that gets people online. And I'd argue that producing something that's so simple that people want to talk about how it made their lives easier, it saved them time, I only had to spend 30 seconds on there and I got what I needed, is the way this plays into that agenda. And by the way, I'd never question Martha, ever.
Oh, no, I don't. All due respect. Anyway, you can see the alpha. I believe it's at alpha.gov.uk. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to Charles and to Tom. For next week's Untangling the Web column, I'm asking what the web has done for Britishness. I have a question for you. Inspired by the Times' 2007 list of the essential 120 books about Britishness, they included everything from Orwell's 1984 to the 2008 IKEA catalogue. If an alien landed on Earth and you had to show it a single website that you felt summed up Britishness, what would it be? Tom, what would it be? Oh, on the spot. Look at the eyes on you.
Britishness. Oh no! I'll tell you what it is. It's Matthew Somerville's train timetable website, traintimes.org.uk. The fact that a train enthusiast and a web enthusiast recreated the entire train timetable system because he just wanted to in his bedroom.
That is pretty British, isn't it? And Charles, what would you say is the website that sums up Britishness for you?
I was sort of going to say Yars.co.uk because it's sort of, you know, it's got all sort of vaguely British human life is there.
Which .co.uk?
Guardian.
Oh, Guardian. Which, oh, yes, of course.
You know, the one where you're on now.
What, you're saying you have America next? I thought that was your...
Well, yeah, you know, but that's sort of, you know, we've only lent it to them. That's a really, really difficult question, and I don't have a snap answer.
Well, send your answers to on Twitter to at AlexK, A-L-E-K-S-K, or guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'll put them up on the Untangling the website and in the Observer's Discover section on Sunday. The producer of this week's Tech Weekly was Scott Colley, and I am Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.